Welcome to the Disability News on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. Today's program will include a piece about ASU graduate Athena Garcia and her commitment to make a difference for students with disabilities. We'll have an article about efforts to obtain approval for the first National Museum of the Blind in Baltimore. We'll also hear an article from the Braille Monitor about a lawsuit filed on behalf of two West Virginia University graduate students based on the university's failure to provide reasonable accommodations for their visual impairments as required by the ADA. And we'll have other articles as well, including this one from Livability Now entitled Birding, A Fun and Accessible Adventure for Anyone by Emily Nichols. Birding or birdwatching isn't just for experts with notebooks and binoculars. It's an enjoyable activity for anyone. Birding doesn't require fancy gear, years of experience, or specialized training. Birding is especially wonderful for people with disabilities, as it can be enjoyed anywhere outside at any time. If you ever thought birding was too hard, expensive, or exclusive, it's time to think differently. With just a few basic tools and an open mind, you can begin a fun and affordable journey. Whether you're looking for a great family outing, a solo adventure, or a new way to connect with nature, the birds are awaiting you. For families and groups, birding is an easy way to get outside and inspire curiosity in kids. It's a great way to spend time together, whether you're exploring trails or relaxing in the park. You may have heard the phrase, "A little birdie told me," but don't just take my word for it. Take it from me and my friends in the field. What is birding? Birding is observing birds in their natural habitats as a hobby or scientific quest. Even though I've been birding for a few years, I still think of myself as a beginner. With more than 11,000 bird species around the world, it's a journey of discovery that lasts a lifetime. Birding promotes well-being by reducing stress, enhancing mindfulness, and staying in the present moment. Many birders share their spark bird, the bird or moment that ignited their passion. For me, it was the discovery of a family of great horned owls nesting on the side of a palm tree in my neighborhood. What began as a daily walk turned into a passion. At sunrise and sunset each day from May to August 2023, I observed a pair of great horned owls as they raised three young owls. I loved watching the family eat, sleep, learn to hunt, and I eventually watched the three owlets fly away to begin their own journeys. During those times, I found a sense of myself again. I often say birds make the best therapists. As I observed the owls and other birds, I learned to be present, connect with nature, relax my body and brain, and appreciate life in new ways. What happens when you go birding? One of the joys of birding is the element of surprise. Whether it's a red-tailed hawk in the sky, a bright red northern cardinal in the bushes, or a great blue heron by the water, each bird sighting is a unique discovery. For many birders, finally seeing a bird we've been wanting to find is thrilling. The excitement keeps us engaged. Beyond solo adventures, birding is also a fantastic way to connect with a community. I've had the joy of birding with friends out in the field as part of Ability 360's 360 Outdoors Exploring Arizona Adaptive Hiking Series. These community hikes are designed to refresh the spirit and are a collaboration between Ability 360, Barrow Neurological Institute, and the Arizona Spinal Cord Injury Association. Accessible birding trails allow for easier focus on birds without worrying about the difficulty and safety of the path. Caitlin Verfurth, then program manager for 360 Outdoors, added birding to the 2024 adaptive hike in Payson, Arizona to engage the community and enhance our experience. How does birding feel? During the Exploring Arizona hike in Payson, participants like wheelchair user Matthew Lockwood found that birding helped him stay present. He explains, "Birding keeps you in the moment. You're not thinking about anything else. Of course, random negative thoughts come, but focusing on a raven or another bird helps bring you back to the present." Rebecca Bukowski, who uses a cane to walk, appreciated how community outings and an easy activity like birding helped her safely return to hiking. She shared, "The nice thing is that because of all the help I have received through therapy and Ability 360 and Barrows creating the trip, I could safely try hiking again. I used to practically live outside 24/7, so it was a beautiful morning getting to spend my time exercising while being outdoors." One woman reflected on her journey, saying her goal used to be to take just 7 steps, and now she walks 7,000 steps. On outings like these hikes, she found she could pay less attention to her headaches and enjoy nature more. These examples, and others like them, illustrate the power of mindfulness, community, and birding to enhance overall well-being. How and where can you start birding? These positive reflections are a few of many reasons I love to share birding, and I'm not alone. Since 2020, the birding community has become more welcoming, and it's growing. When you're ready to start birding, there are plenty of resources. Apps like Merlin Bird ID and eBird from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology help identify birds and track sightings while contributing to conservation efforts as citizen scientists. Organizations like BirdAbility are leading efforts to make birding more accessible. They offer inclusive bird walks, an online BirdAbility map of birding trails that are easy to navigate, adaptive equipment, and more resources to invite more people into the birding community. With a great variety of digital tools, you can enjoy birding from your backyard, your car, or even from the comfort of your home. I'm a local captain for BirdAbility, and I'm eager to share the joys of birding in every way I can. I hope to see some of you out in the field or online sharing your experiences. A little birdie told me, "Birding is waiting for you. Take a moment, open your awareness, look around, listen, and enjoy nature's wild winged beauty." This next article comes from Arizona State University's ASU News. The title, "ASU Grad Committed to Making a Difference for Students with Disabilities," by Caitlin Bickel. Making a difference on campus for your peers with disabilities is no small feat, but that's exactly what Athena Garcia, who studied at the Mary Lou Fulton College for Teaching and Learning Innovation, accomplished during her time at Arizona State University. Garcia, who studied special education with a focus in visual impairments at ASU's West Valley campus in her hometown of Glendale, said, "She always knew she wanted to pursue a career in which she could help others. When I found out that I had a disability myself, specifically a visual impairment, I always knew that I wanted to help other people. But my disability inspired me to jump into the field of visual impairments and become that teacher that provides their students with the accommodations that they need to be supported in the classroom, as I didn't receive that support myself when I was in public school," Garcia said. So, in the fall of 2023, Garcia started a student organization to support students with visual impairments. "I started a student club called Braille Devils on this campus because I knew that there wasn't enough representation of the disability community, specifically for those students with visual impairments," Garcia said. "I really wanted to help other students feel seen and heard through the student club, and we did so many fun activities." In addition to leading the Braille Devils, Garcia is an involved member of the Accessibility Coalition, a student coalition representing the disability community at ASU. She also provided support for her peers by working in the Student Accessibility Office at the West Valley campus. I became a part of the Accessibility Coalition because I knew I wanted to continue giving back to the disability community at ASU, Garcia said. I became the director of education, where I educated different student clubs on campus, in addition to the broader ASU community, on what disability is like, how we support students in the Student Accessibility Office and those with disabilities, and how we can bring awareness to the disability community so that way they're represented and seen on campus. Garcia was also an active member of Devils Adapt, a student-led training program for adaptive athletes based at the Tempe campus. It's really been an amazing experience for me because I've been going there 3 days a week to exercise, and it's really taught me that your disability doesn't have to be a barrier to fitness and that fitness is for everybody, Garcia said. In addition to working on campus and all of her extracurricular activities during her time at ASU, Garcia worked as a student teacher in the Gilbert Public Schools District. I started my student teaching experience in the spring 2025 semester, Garcia said. I gained hands-on experience with an amazing mentor teacher who taught students with visual impairments. Through him, I really got to learn how to teach students every day, get to know students better, and accommodate them and make their curriculum accessible in the classroom. After her graduation, Garcia plans to apply to work in a nearby school district. My plan after graduation is to really become that teacher that makes a difference for students with disabilities who are in grades K through 12 in a school district, specifically those with visual impairments, as I'll be able to relate to them and understand what their strengths and goals are. Her advice for her fellow Sun Devils still in school? Follow your passions and get involved. One piece of advice I would give to anyone starting at ASU is to really get involved in the university, because that's where you discover what passion you want to pursue or even find friendships you'll be making along the way, Garcia said. You're really supposed to make the most of your university experience because that's how you grow as a person. Now, here's a piece from the Arizona Republic entitled, Buckeye's New Rideshare Program to Offer Low-Cost Trips in 2026. This is by John Leos, and it was published December 6, 2025. Buckeye residents will have access to a new mode of low-cost public transportation as the city's Community Services Department launches a pilot rideshare program next year. The program is part of an updated multi-year strategy to broaden public transportation in one of the fastest-growing cities in the state. Planned to launch in the spring-summer of 2026, the city's transit service will offer ride-share services to eligible residents, similar to Lyft or Uber, but at a much lower cost. Details of the program are still being ironed out by project managers, but initial plans indicate that residents seeking a ride will need to make an appointment with the Community Services Department 1 to 2 days in advance for a cost of about $1 to $3 per one-way trip. To start, the vehicles will run between 6:30 a.m. and 7 p.m. on weekdays, although these hours may change depending on demand. The service is an expansion of a popular program that transports residents over 60 years of age to medical appointments. Officials said that has been oversubscribed. About 16,000 people in this age group live in Buckeye, making up 15% of the total population, according to the city's transit master plan. The new initiative will be available to all members of the public, but it aims to help older adults, people with disabilities, veterans, and low-income individuals travel to major corridors within Buckeye. The program may allow for some exceptions for individuals traveling outside city limits for specialized medical appointments, like cancer treatments. The Community Services Department will hire 3 drivers and a transit coordinator to support the service. The vehicle fleet will consist of a 12-passenger minibus and two recently purchased vans equipped with wheelchair lifts. For residents traveling from Buckeye toward Phoenix, Valley Metro offers one fixed bus route that runs on weekdays, and a van pool commuter service transports groups of travelers at a cost. Buckeye used Arizona lottery funds to purchase the new vehicles for the pilot program, and the money for fuel and staff hours were included in the 2026 budget. Future funding for the program will need to be allocated by the City Council each year. Buckeye officials did not immediately specify the overall cost of the program. "This is just like a library service or a park service," said John Willett, Deputy Director of Transportation, at the December 2 Buckeye City Council meeting. "It's a service that we provide to our residents. There's not a lot of money back on it, but it's something we need to do." Next up is an article from the December issue of the Braille Monitor. It's entitled, "A Failure of Access, A Betrayal of Trust. Why Two Blind Students Are Suing West Virginia University," by Gary Wunder. From the editor. "Although we try to avoid litigation if we can, the National Federation of the Blind brings many lawsuits to vindicate the rights of blind students, blind employees, and other blind people who experience discrimination and unequal treatment. Too often, however, many Federationists never meet the courageous individuals who are the faces of our litigation. Gary Wunder has rectified that in this case by interviewing two bright and brave West Virginia University students who are challenging their institution's failure to meet its legal obligations to them. Readers who want to take an even deeper dive can hear part of this story in their own voices on the Nation's Blind podcast. Here is Gary's article. For Harold Rogers and Miranda Lacey, graduate school was supposed to be the final step toward achieving their dreams. Both are high-achieving West Virginia natives enrolled in the Master of Social Work, MSW, program at West Virginia University, WVU. And both share a passion for serving their home state's most vulnerable populations. But as they would soon discover, individual competence and good faith advocacy are often no match for institutional inertia and university reluctance to pivot from a departmental struggle to avoid blame to unified action to create real and equitable opportunity for blind students. Instead, WVU has systematically denied them the tools, materials, and opportunities necessary to learn. Now they and we are plaintiffs in a federal lawsuit against the university, alleging widespread and persistent discrimination that violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. Recognizing that individual students, no matter how competent, often cannot win this kind of battle against a state university on their own, the National Federation of the Blind and the National Federation of the Blind of West Virginia have joined the suit as co-plaintiffs. Using our limited and precious resources, our involvement brings the collective power, legal expertise, and organizational resources necessary to challenge systemic discrimination. In keeping with the Federation's tradition, discussion and negotiations always come before any lawsuit. These negotiations began with these students, came to include NFB of West Virginia, and eventually involved our national body. The student's story is not just one of inaccessible websites, it is a case study in institutional failure, retaliation, and the profound personal cost of being denied an equal education. We went back in time. Both Harold and Miranda are members of the National Federation of the Blind and came to WVU with impressive academic records. Harold was a member of Alpha Delta Mu and an active member of its local chapter. He graduated with honors from West Virginia State University, WVSU, with a BS in social work. He was one of only 23 trainees nationwide selected for a prestigious fellowship funded by the United States Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA. Miranda, also a WVSU honors graduate, is a 2024 NFB National Scholarship winner. She was a member of Psi Chi International Honor Society and the Phi Alpha Social Work Honor Society. Miranda and Harold chose WVU, believing its master's level program would best prepare them for their careers, but the barriers began immediately. Miranda, who lost her remaining vision just before starting the program, found the online new student orientation inaccessible. She was unable to operate on-screen buttons to move through the modules and ultimately had to ask a sighted volunteer for help. She finds it ironic that the process to take her money was accessible, but not the process that would begin her learning at the university. This lack of accessibility, they soon learned, was the norm. Harold describes the situation at WVU bluntly in our interview. "It's like we've gone back in time to before the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990. The lawsuit and our subsequent interview detail a staggering list of accessibility failures that permeate every aspect of the MSW program. Inaccessible learning platform. The university uses Blackboard Ultra. Harold and Miranda report that core functions like the gradebook and course messaging are inaccessible. Interactive elements like true-false or multiple-choice quizzes cannot be operated with a screen reader. Even basic navigation fails, with back buttons that don't function with a screen reader, forcing them to log out and log back in just to move between a module and the main course page. Delayed and unusable materials. Textbooks provided by the Office of Student Accommodations, OSA, arrived piecemeal, not as a whole book, at the start of the semester. The PDF files are often improperly tagged or untagged, making it impossible to use a table of contents, search function, or glossary. Images, such as a brain scan students were meant to analyze, are provided with no alternative text. There is more to a book or an article than text alone. Navigation, the ability to move by sentence, paragraph, heading, page, chapter, part, and other important sections, is absolutely essential if one is to compete productively. With many of these documents, being able to read continuously was impossible because the malformed document would cause the screen reader to jump erratically. Broken university systems. The barriers extend beyond the classroom. The WVU library website's search filters are so complex and poorly organized for a screen reader that it took Miranda an hour to apply filters a sighted student could apply in seconds. Even then, the filtered results were not what she needed. She is forced to have librarians select research articles for her, denying her the ability to conduct her own independent research. Other essential platforms, like Handshake for scheduling meetings and Tevra for managing field placements, are also inaccessible. A personal aide or a reader. When faced with these barriers, the university's response, according to the students, has been a masterpiece in blame shifting and gaslighting. Miranda, in particular, has been asked to spend 5 to 10 hours a week in meetings with WVU staff demonstrating the inaccessibility of their systems, effectively performing unpaid accessibility testing for the university that is failing her. You may be surprised to find how long it takes to find a problem, be requested to show it to them, and then have them ask for a Zoom call to see if the problem has been fixed, she said. When Miranda requested a human reader to access the vast amount of inaccessible content, a standard accommodation, her request was met with confusion and denial. Miranda was told by Disability Services that a private reader would be considered a personal care attendant, an assertion she called degrading and so humiliating. The request was formally denied as recently as February 2025, but the university has suddenly granted her use of a visual interpreter through IRA and limited assistance by a graduate student. The field placement cornerstone crumbles. The most critical failure, and one that figures prominently in the lawsuit, involves their field placements. The MSW field experience is described by WVU as a cornerstone of the degree, where students learn from practicing social workers. For both Harold and Miranda, this cornerstone crumbled because WVU failed to ensure their placement sites were accessible. Harold's story, retaliation. Harold was placed at an agency called the Counseling Connection in the fall of 2023. He quickly found that the agency's computers did not have the screen reader or magnification software he needed to perform his duties. The complaint filed noted that the WVU field placement office was unwilling to assist him in obtaining accommodations. The stress from the inaccessibility exacerbated Harold's pre-existing health conditions. The agency ultimately terminated his placement. What happened next was retaliation. The university brought him up on academic charges. They accused him of falsifying his timesheets, timesheets he had to log in the inaccessible Tevera system. They accused him of falsifying a signature on a form, which he explains was a simple formatting error due to his screen reader. As a result, WVU placed him on probation, removed him from his prestigious HRSA fellowship, and forced him to pay back the $5,000 stipend. His graduation, originally set for August 2024, is now delayed by nearly 2 years to May 2026. Miranda's story, isolation. Miranda's first field placement was at the Appalachian Center for Independent Living. When she requested JAWS screen reading software on the agency computers, WVU refused to pay for the license. She was forced to negotiate for access herself. The agency eventually installed the software on an old, isolated computer in the back of a hallway, limiting her ability to integrate with her colleagues. For her current placement at the YWCA, she credits the agency with high marks and believes it is doing everything it can to accommodate her. What they don't know, they are willingly and enthusiastically trying to learn. In contrast, she says, the university has done nothing to facilitate access other than to help her with scanning 11 documents, the forms used as part of the intake process. The human cost of injustice. The toll of this fight has been immense. Harold has been hospitalized for depression directly related to the stress. Miranda, a single mother, has found some of her health conditions exacerbated and has developed a new one, which she attributes to the stress of the program. The time that this program has taken from me is time that I have missed with my children, she told me, her voice heavy. That is precious. Of course, these students are fighting not just for themselves, but for a principle. We just want systemic change, Miranda said. Harold hopes the lawsuit will set a critical legal precedent. What's at stake here, he explained, is whether or not the university has a legal obligation to facilitate the accommodations at the field placement. I don't believe there is any 21st century legal precedent that will be as meaningful as the one for which we're pressing. When asked whether the students were looking for real change or a settlement, both were firm in their responses. We are poor folks and could really use the money, but that's not what this is about, Miranda said. Their message is unmistakably clear in their words and emphasis. They are entitled to an education preparing them for the noble profession they seek, and nothing short of that will do. They are also committed to making the experience of future students seeking their degrees as free of pain and stress as they can. This is precisely why organized collective action is essential. Their goal, and the goal of the National Federation of the Blind in bringing the suit, is to ensure no student has to endure what they have. every blind person must recognize that the law is not self-enforcing. Filing and following through with a lawsuit normally requires money, expertise, and a collective commitment to the people and principles at stake. Through the National Federation of the Blind, we marshal these forces and demand first-class treatment for blind citizens. We provide the structure needed to raise the money, hire the legal experts, and develop the deep organizational expertise required to hold a major institution like WVU accountable. As Harold so powerfully stated, laws are only as powerful as the people who are willing to fight to protect them. Harold Rogers and Miranda Lacey are fighting, and now they have the organized strength of the nation's blind behind them. Their university should be ashamed that it came to this. We should be heartened by their willingness to stand up for their rights, to exercise the humility and good sense to ask for help, and to lend their strength through involvement with us as together we work to help those of us who are blind to live the lives we want. In the National Federation of the Blind, we do what we do out of love and respect for our fellow blind people. Everything we do is based on a shared belief in one another, and that belief carries with it nothing less than the responsibility to extend our hands and hearts in a spirit of helpfulness through action. Before the next article, here's a reminder that you're listening to the Disability News on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now from ABC Baltimore. Baltimore could become home to first National Museum for the Blind in the United States. Written by Jeff Morgan. Published December 5, 2025. Baltimore. Blind people could soon have their achievements celebrated at a national museum in Baltimore if Maryland's federal lawmakers succeed in their efforts to establish the facility. Congressional representatives are working to designate a National Museum for the Blind at the National Federation of the Blind headquarters in Baltimore. The proposed museum would be the first of its kind in the United States and the first museum owned and operated by blind people. The stories of blind people are worthy of preservation, study, and celebration at the highest levels of our nation. They are stories of joy, accomplishment, and determination, said Mark Riccobono, president of the National Federation of the Blind. The museum would showcase remarkable achievements by blind individuals, including Eric Weimeyer's historic 2001 climb of Mount Everest as the first blind person to accomplish that feat. Currently, a series of plaques commemorate the achievements. Riccobono emphasized the ongoing need to change perceptions about blindness. Blind people are much closer to equality in society than ever before, but blindness is still feared more than cancer and death itself. But not by those of us who are living the lives we want every day as people who happen to be blind, Riccobono said. The museum requires congressional approval to become federally recognized. Congressman Kwasi Mfume, who represents Maryland's 7th District, and Senator Chris Van Hollen are leading the legislative effort. So when the museum opens its doors, and it will, we're going to fight this tooth and nail to win this. When it opens its doors, as you know, it will be the first museum of its kind, Mfume said. Federal designation would provide significant advantages for the museum, including federal protections and easier access to funding opportunities. This next piece comes from Mother Jones. It's entitled, Alabama wants to lower the bar for executing disabled people, if SCOTUS lets it. The law is clear. There's more to intellectual disability than IQ tests. Will Trump's justices care? By Julia Matro. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in Ham v. Smith, a death penalty case that will decide whether intellectual disability can be ruled out on the basis of IQ tests alone. Long before he was convicted of murder in 1997, Joseph Clifton Smith was placed in schooling for an intellectual disability. Smith had 5 documented IQ scores by the time he was tried, all around the bottom 5% of the population, 4 of which, his legal team has argued, fall in the range of mild intellectual disability. The state of Alabama disagrees. Anyone scoring 70 or above on one test, its attorney general contends, is intelligent enough to execute. In 2023, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals rejected that argument, setting the stage for a Supreme Court turnaround on IQ and capital punishment. The Supreme Court has previously stated that IQ tests alone fail to holistically determine intellectual disability in 2002's Atkins v. Virginia, which also established that executing people with intellectual disabilities violated the 8th Amendment. Reaffirmed in 2014 in Hall v. Florida, and most recently in 2017's Moore v. Texas. But Atkins and Hall were close decisions, and the court's conservative majority has since grown. It's important to have a holistic assessment of the person, said Shira Wakeschlag, general counsel and senior executive officer for legal advocacy at the ARC, such as education records and other documentation from childhood. IQ scores are a factor in determining intellectual disability, Wakeschlag said, but they vary, and the tests don't always offer consistent results. An amicus brief from the American Psychological Association, American Psychiatric Association, and Alabama Psychological Association in support of Smith's case similarly argued that because the diagnostic inquiry is necessarily holistic and requires the exercise of clinical judgment, no single datum, such as IQ test scores, is dispositive of intellectual functioning. An October filing by Alabama's Department of Corrections Commissioner John Q. Hamm pushes for a very narrow definition of intellectual disability defined by an IQ below 70 and argues that the holistic rhetoric is just window dressing for a novel and indefensible change in constitutional law. If you tilt your head just right and squint and apply this particular statistical principle in isolation without considering anything else, then you get the result that Alabama thinks you should get, said University of New Mexico School of Law adjunct professor Ann Delfa, whose work focuses on intellectual disabilities and the justice system. That's not what intellectual disability is about. The court has said repeatedly, at different times, that intellectual disability is determined through clinical judgment, through a comprehensive analysis, Wakeschlag said. It's not a number. The Supreme Court's decision to hear the case is perhaps unexpected, given the clear precedent in its rulings that IQ tests are not enough to establish intellectual disability and may signal a likely break with precedent. A decision that effectively overturns the court's past rulings on intellectual disability and the death penalty would encourage states to define down intellectual disability and any safeguards that come with it in their criminal justice systems, in line with a wider push echoed by conservative proposals like the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 to strip disability protections from schools, workplaces, and other sites of public life. Now here's a piece from the Disability Scoop entitled, In First, Wheelchair User Set to Go to Space, by Sean Heasley, published December 9, 2025. An upcoming Blue Origin flight will mark a first for people with disabilities. The company said its next mission will include Michaela Mickey Benthouse, an aerospace and mechatronics engineer at the European Space Agency who uses a wheelchair. Benthouse will be one of 6 passengers on Blue Origin's New Shepard rocket, which will travel above the Kármán line, the internationally recognized boundary of space. Benthouse has used a wheelchair since a 2018 mountain biking accident left her with a spinal cord injury. "I'm beyond excited," Benthouse said in a social media post. "I thought my dream of going to space had ended forever when I had my accident. But over the past few months, I've been working with an amazing and supportive team to make it possible for a wheelchair user to take part in a suborbital flight, something that's never been done before." Previously, Benthouse has flown on a zero-G research flight and participated in an analog astronaut mission, which simulates a space mission. The upcoming mission will be the 37th for Blue Origin's New Shepard, a fully autonomous vehicle. The 62-mile trip lasts 11 minutes, allowing travelers to experience several minutes of weightlessness and see life-changing views of Earth, the company said. "We're thrilled to welcome Mickey aboard New Shepard. Our mission is to make space accessible to everyone, and this is a meaningful step toward that future and an inspiration for others to see what's possible," a Blue Origin spokesperson told Disability Scoop. No date has been announced for the flight. "This feels like an important step since space travel for people with disabilities is still in its very early days," Benthouse said. "I might be the first, but have no intention of being the last." In another piece from the Disability Scoop, United Airlines to expand disability employment effort, by Judith Kohler, The Denver Post. Denver. Four United Airlines employees talking about their jobs sounds like the kind of workers that most companies would love to snap up. They arrive early for work, they're praised for being helpful, and they have to be reminded to put in for vacation. The four are among 18 employees across United's system who have taken on new careers through a collaboration with Special Olympics that airline spokesman Russell Carlton called an industry first. United started the Special Olympics Service Ambassador Program in 2019 in Chicago during National Disability Employment Awareness Month and expanded it to Denver, Houston, and Washington, D.C. Plans are underway to hire Special Olympics athletes at United hubs in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Newark. The Special Olympics ambassadors, who work part-time as customer service representatives for United at Denver International Airport, recently marked their fourth year on the job. Helene Carmona Schmidt, also a customer representative, works directly with the four employees and is a mentor to them. "I don't like calling this a program because it truly is a pathway of employment. There is no end date," Schmidt said. "They are truly employed by United Airlines, and they get all the benefits." The ambassadors applied for the positions and shadowed other United employees on the job before joining the staff. "They are completely mainstreamed," Schmidt said. Before working at DIA, Hannah Joy Atkinson, Chris McElroy, Cody Field, and David Riley all distinguished themselves through their participation with Special Olympics Colorado. They've traveled across the country and around the world to competitions and brought home medals. They speak at events and serve as leaders for other athletes. Field, 33, of Centennial, a Special Olympics snowboard and skier, scored a gig as a reporter at WWE's WrestleMania XL in Philadelphia in 2024. "I was the first ever community impact correspondent at WrestleMania XL," he said, going on to name some of his wrestling idols that he met. Field is excited about his job with United. Along with the other three, he helps people print out bag tags and other items they need. He gives travelers directions and summons other customer representatives when needed. "There's a lot of things I love about this job, especially when I'm actually helping with customers," Field said. McElroy, 37, of Aurora, has been a Special Olympics athlete since middle school, competing in swimming, soccer, floor hockey, flag football, bowling, and golf. In 2015, he won a gold medal in swimming at the Special Olympics World Games in Los Angeles. When it comes to working for United Airlines, McElroy said, "This is my number one job ever." McElroy said he arrives to work about an hour before his shift and gets everything situated and ready to go. His favorite part of the job? Having him as a boss, McElroy said, gesturing to Stephen Stout, United's managing director of customer service in Denver. "They keep me in line," Stout replied. "They sometimes quiz me on things. The team is really in tune with what it is we look for here in Denver and at United Airlines." On a recent shift, the four employees were in the lobby, helping travelers print out and attach bag tags and boarding passes and steering people to where they needed to go. Atkinson, 30, of Littleton, said she takes her work seriously. "At the end of the day, I would do absolutely anything and everything I can to improve the quality of my job for the sake of my team," Atkinson said. Away from work, Atkinson is busy representing Special Olympics, where she has competed in swimming, basketball, and cycling. She is an alumni reporter for Lady Gaga's Channel Kindness, where three of her stories were published in the book Channel Kindness. Atkinson's favorite part of her job in customer service is making a difference in the lives of people traveling through the airport. "Sometimes people are in a rush. I like to make their lives a little bit less stressful." Riley, 41, of Centennial, has been a Special Olympics athlete since he was 10 years old. He has competed in track and field, softball, volleyball, and basketball, and is part of an athlete leadership program. He also works at Colorado Avalanche and Denver Nuggets games as an usher or taking tickets. At United, Riley enjoys working with Stout. He's a very nice boss. What he likes about the job is interacting with the passengers. "I like talking to them and asking them where they're going on their flights," Riley said. "I tag their bags and car seats and like seeing people with their little ones." Schmidt said the four are held to the same rules and expectations as other United employees. "It's meaningful work for these young adults that they can take on to make it bigger and better." Megan Scremmen, president and CEO of Special Olympics Colorado, said the four have shown that individuals with disabilities deserve as much opportunity to be in the workplace as everyone else does, and that they are fully capable of being productive, excellent team members and employees. Scremmen believes seeing people with disabilities working in such visible positions might expand the public's perceptions about what people with disabilities can do. "I think every individual interaction that Cody and Hannah and Chris and David are having with people within the airport has a ripple effect," Scremmen said. "This is a job that they have earned and they are keeping through their work and their commitment to their leaders within United Airlines." Next up, Ed Department sued by disability advocates over plans to outsource programs, by Michelle Diament, published December 4, 2025. Disability advocates and education stakeholders are challenging the Trump administration's steps to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education, arguing in a lawsuit that the actions will harm kids with developmental disabilities. The Arc of the United States and a coalition of educators, school districts, and employee unions say in an amended lawsuit filed last month that the Education Department's plan to transfer management of dozens of programs to other federal agencies is illegal. In recent weeks, the administration announced plans to move more than 100 programs into agencies that have little or no experience running them. These transfers strip the department of its core functions and threaten to unravel the systems that help schools serve students with disabilities and other historically marginalized groups, said Katie Neese, CEO of the ARC, who previously served as a top official in the Education Department's Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services, or OSERS. In November, the Education Department said that it would enter into 6 agreements with 4 other federal agencies to co-manage programs covering K-12 post-secondary education and more. The actions are seen as a workaround to move forward on the Trump administration's goal of shuttering the Education Department without approval from Congress. So far, the agreements do not include OSERS, which houses offices overseeing implementation of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and Vocational Rehabilitation, or the Office of Civil Rights, known as OCR, which handles disability discrimination complaints, but it's unclear if that will remain the case. Earlier this year, President Donald Trump said that he would move oversight of special needs programs to the Department of Health and Human Services, and a senior education department official said last month that the agency is still exploring options for both OSERS and OCR. Moving the IDEA to a different department is not only unlawful, but would also weaken the critical systems that ensure students with disabilities can learn, grow, and thrive, the lawsuit argues. The Department of Education is the only federal agency with the expertise and infrastructure to uphold the IDEA's promise. The suit indicates that efforts in recent months to fire nearly all staff responsible for administering IDEA, which are currently on hold, violate the law, and that terminations at OCR and the closure of most of the office's regional branches mean that the Civil Rights Office has all but stopped functioning. The updated complaint comes in a case known as Somerville versus Trump, which was initially filed in March by the Somerville Public School Committee, the East Hampton School District, the American Federation of Teachers, AFT Massachusetts, AFSCME Council 93, the American Association of University Professors, and the Service Employees International Union. The coalition is represented by Democracy Forward, and the matter has been consolidated with another case, New York versus McMahon. The Education Department did not respond to a request for comment on the matter. And finally, an article by Sean Heasley in the Disability Scoop entitled SeaWorld, Busch Gardens, Other Theme Parks Face ADA Investigation. This was published on December 5th, 2025. The U.S. Department of Justice is investigating several major theme parks for possibly discriminating against people with disabilities. The agency said it launched an investigation into United Parks and Resorts Incorporated to assess its compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. The company owns or licenses theme parks including SeaWorld, Busch Gardens, Aquatica, Sesame Place, and others. The ADA protects every American from disability-based discrimination in places of public accommodation, including theme parks, said Assistant Attorney General Harmit K. Dillon from the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. We are committed to upholding our federal civil rights laws so that no guest is denied access or charged more because of a disability. Officials with the federal agency's Civil Rights Division and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Middle District of Florida said they were prompted to act after receiving complaints from people with disabilities alleging that 3 of United Parks' properties are violating the ADA by banning rollator walkers with seats. Without the walkers, the guests indicated in their complaints that they were unable to access the parks. Further, the complaints allege that the only option that guests were given was to pay for mobility aids that were not appropriate for their needs. The Justice Department said the complaints emerged from SeaWorld Orlando, Busch Gardens, Tampa Bay, and Aquatica, Orlando. The agency pointed to a page on SeaWorld Orlando's website indicating that its policy on rollator walkers had been updated as part of a regular review of safety and accessibility practices. As a result, rollators and wheeled walkers with seats are not permitted at our Orlando parks, the website states. If guests arrive with a non-approved rollator walker, the site indicates that their devices can be checked and held while they use an approved rollator without a seat or a wheelchair, both provided at no cost. Accessibility pages on websites for Busch Gardens Tampa Bay and Aquatica Orlando feature similar information. Officials with United Parks and Resorts did not respond to a request for comment. The Justice Department is urging anyone who believes they have been a victim of disability discrimination at parks affiliated with United Parks and Resorts Incorporated to file a complaint with the agency's Civil Rights Division. That concludes this edition of the Disability News. This is your volunteer reader, John Curry. Thank you for tuning in, and please join us again next time.